The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Here with Jim today. So, the last EDU show I did solo. I've done a Q&A show also solo not that long ago, so you've been getting a big dose of me, but Jim's back in the studio, so we'll get him in high fidelity this time, not called in from the south near the latest wildfire in Colorado.
I like how you say in the studio. Why don't you tell people where I am?
You're in your own private studio. Has a table and a microphone, and it's acoustically beneficial.
You forget the dead mouse in the bathroom.
Protected from COVID because there's a door. And you have your own private bathroom facilities. I'm not sure what you're complaining about.
Oh, yeah, this is a high-end place. I'm in the attic, folks. The house was built in 1905. I'm remodeled the entire place, but I am actually in the most original part of the building, the attic. It was a small attic, wasn't it?
It still is.
True. But, I mean, in 1905, you know when I bought the house, Chris, and listeners, there was one closet in the entire house. And you know when you come in, Chris, and the little coffee nook is right there on the left?
Mm-hmm.
That was actually a closet. They took the walls down. And the window that is right in front of the front porch wasn't there. That is a window we put in. It was a closet. So it's just in 1905, people didn't have much stuff. So the entire house, which is only 1,000 square feet, had one closet. So the entire family, I guess, just shared one closet. Could you imagine that now?
No.
So anyways.
I can't imagine having one closet just for my junk. Much less my whole family's worth of stuff.
For all three of your polo shirts?
Hey, I have 27 polo shirts.
I would believe it. You know, Chris, folks who don't know, a couple listeners have come out and visited us, so they probably met you. But if you don't know, Chris wears just polo shirts. I don't think I've ever seen you even in a sweater.
No, I'm not a big sweater person.
No, but I mean, even in the winter, he's got a short sleeve polo shirt on. I don't get it.
It's my uniform. Now, they're not all the same color. I'm not quite that weird.
No, but it's just polo. Polo, polo, polo. You know there are other types of shirts besides polos, right?
You know, I don't think you've noticed, but I've not been wearing polos recently because we haven't had people coming into the office. So I have a collarless polo-like shirt. It's not a polo shirt, though. There's no collar. I'm not sure what they call this, but
it's called a T-shirt.
No, because it has buttons on it. T-shirts don't have buttons.
True.
I have a fancy T-shirt with buttons.
A button T-shirt. But Chris dresses very plain, very casual. You can tell he's married and just doesn't care about his appearance anymore.
Exactly.
Whereas I am still trying to find a woman, so I do try to dress nice, even while at work, when there's no clients coming to visit us.
Well, you never know when one's going to wander in or when you're going to go out Yeah.
Exactly. You expect to meet one when you least expect it. And if I don't look good, Lord knows my face isn't winning it over, so hopefully I can get someone with my dress.
It's not like you're disfigured or anything.
No, but one must admit, the older I get, the hotter it gets.
Well, yeah.
All right. So we, folks, going to lead in on this Q&A show with Social Security like we normally do, but I'm going to do something. I don't want to say I'm going to do something a little bit different. Chris is going to address, on our last Q&A show, we had a very good question from a listener, and Chris pointed out his personal answer. And I think this brings us a little bit, Chris, to the art and science of financial planning.
Yeah, in this particular case, I actually had two people. You only got a copy of one of them, but two
people. No, I got
people,
both. I got
did
both
you?
Emails,
okay, two people reached out to us about, I guess, bringing up something I didn't mention. And I didn't mention because I didn't think it was a significant deal, but they're absolutely right. There are other moving parts to the story that went on last time. And just to recap, last time we had a person who was asking us if it mattered much, should he worry about claiming at 69 and 11 months or 70 years old? If that 1 month, you know, what would be the big deal there? And, you know, my simple answer was there's such a little difference in the benefit with only a 1 month claiming difference that in the long run, it's really, you know, six of one, half a dozen another. Once you've made it that far, it doesn't really matter. If you need it that month earlier for some reason, fire it up. It's you're not going to regret the decision. And I stopped it there. But savvy listeners of ours pointed out that there are other ramifications to this. And Jim has an email along those lines. So I don't know how much of it you want to share with them. But
well, I want to share a lot, of course, because someone pointed out, two people pointed out, as Chris said, when mistakes get made,
out. This does not rise to the label of a mistake.
I'm just saying.
Why don't you share the email with people? They can judge for themselves whether this was a, quote, mistake.
Well, it's refreshing because the big thing that I noticed, if you remember, there was a spat, I think about 2 or 3 weeks, where misspeaking or mistakes were made on this show in the springtime. And it also pointed out to us, as listeners wrote in and pointed out to us, that these misspeaks or mistakes, if you will, were made. We also noticed that our listeners had spelling problems, if you remember, because they kept spelling your name. J-I-M said this, J-I-M said that. And clearly they meant Chris, but they don't quite know how to spell.
Mm-hmm.
These two listeners were brilliant because they knew how to spell.
Oh, and they dialed it right into me.
They mm-hmm. said Chris.
They properly
said,
identified
right,
me.
C-H-R-I-S is how you spell Chris. And in the mm-hmm. springtime, so many people were spelling Chris, J-I-M. J-I-M said this, J-I-M said that.
I think you're equating things that aren't quite equatable.
It's my show. I make the rules.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
We'll let people judge for themselves. Go ahead and share with the share the feedback with the group here.
But what I was getting at, though, all jokes aside, it highlighted, when I read these emails, it highlighted the art and the science of financial planning. The science part of what they were saying is true, and I'll let you explain it. And I would wager both these listeners got that level of knowledge through this show, because I don't know anyone else like you have who has pointed out how delayed retirement credits work. And I would wager, Chris, most advisors don't know how delayed retirement credits work, because they think, oh, you're going to get 8% a year for every year you delay. But what happens when you don't delay a full year? What happens when you delay just a year and 2 months? How do those 2 months get factored, and when do you get that money? Only you pointed all that out. But these listeners were key, and they honed in, Chris, that the gentleman turned 70 in May. So that was still kind of early in the year, wasn't quite halfway through the year. And then they pointed out something that I'll let you get into. And they said, we're just kind of questioning with that, would you want to change your answer? And you stuck to your guns on both. I'll let you get into the answer, and said to them, no, my answer doesn't change, but yes, you are correct and will mention this. So I'm going to read one of the emails. I won't read both of them, but this one began, and it said, Chris, see, notice Chris, he got that right, Chris, there was no Jim in there, by the way, just Chris, just pointing out, Chris, question on the last Q&A show. If someone starts to collect their Social Security at 69 and 11 months, don't they forfeit the delayed retirement credits for that year until January of the next year? So in your response for someone collecting 1 month before they turn 70, they are getting a smaller benefit from that point until January of the following year. At least that's my understanding from listening to you on what happens if you claim after your full retirement age and under 70 years old. So he kind of summed up what we were saying. And before you jump into your answer, bring to our listeners' attention again just how delayed retirement credits work and are credited when you turn them on before age 70.
Okay. So the way people think it works is, first of all, one misconception is the 8% per year gets credited as a yearly amount. You have to wait a whole year, and then your benefit goes up by 8%, et cetera. In fact, they keep track of it by month. So you're going to get 1 month's worth of delayed retirement credit each month that you delay, which turns out to be 0.67% per month. Where do I get that? 8 divided by 12. So you get 0.67% every single month that you delay. So in this case of his age, he was expected to turn 70 next year. So that makes his full retirement age 66. So if he were to make it to 70, he'd have 4 full years of delayed retirement credits, or 32%. If he delays 1 month less, he would only get 31.33%, right? He's going to miss that month's worth. And that was my point in my answer, that the difference between the amount of delayed retirement credits is so small that it's not really going to affect things. But what most people don't realize is that if you claim at 69 and 11 months, you don't immediately get the benefit of all 31.33% increase of delayed retirement credits. They actually assign and grant to you the delayed retirement credits on your record January of every year. So January 1st of 2021, where this person was going to turn 70, he would have only earned up to that point 28.65% increase. Based on his May birth date, he doesn't have, when he reaches the end of 2020, they award him on his record. He hasn't claimed yet, but they're going to make a note, hey, give this person, when they claim, 28.65% increase over his PIA. And anytime during that year after that, that he claims, those are the credits he's going to get, unless he waits to 70. There's a special rule. If you wait till 70 to claim, they immediately grant you all 32% in this particular case. If his full retirement age was 67, he'd only get 3 years benefit, or 24%. But whatever full award of delayed retirement credits you're entitled to when you turn 70, no matter what month that is, they give you the full amount. There's no issue. At 69 and 11 months, he's not going to lose out on just a month's worth of credit. He's actually going to lose out on all months, you know, the May all the way back to January, all 5 months of delayed retirement credits. Now you might say, well, that's a huge penalty, but it's a penalty just for the rest of that year. So in 2021, if he were to claim in April, a month before his 70th year, his 70th birthday, they would pay him 28.65% more than his PIA for the rest of the year. And then January of the following year, they would say, oh, you actually deserve a little bit more. You deserve 31.33%, so we're going to give you the extra 3.35%. And moving forward, and you're made whole at that point. And you'll live the rest of your life getting a higher benefit. You missed off that 0.67% for the last month. To put some numbers to this, let's just assume, and I'm going to use $1,000 as his PIA, as primary insurance amount, just to make the numbers really easy to follow. If he claims in May, he's going to get $1,320 per month immediately, right? 32% more than $1,000. If he claims in April, he's only going to get $1,286.50. He's only going to get the 28.65% immediately. For the rest of that year, though, he's going to collect 9 months at $1,286.50. He's going to collect April through December. Now, we all know they're paid in arrears. I'm not going to go down that path, but he'll earn 9 months worth at $1,286.50 for a total of $11,579. Surprisingly, if he waits a month and claims in May and gets that $1,320 with all the delayed retirement credits, he's only going to get 8 months, so he's only going to collect $10,560. He's going to get about $1,000 less in the first year by waiting the extra month in my particular example. So he actually starts out ahead, not behind, even though he got robbed, I guess you could say, because he never gets them back, the 5 months or the 4 months worth of delayed retirement credits that he didn't get because he claimed in April and it wasn't his 70th birthday. He does miss out on those from April through the end of the year. They don't grant them to him until January. Then in January moving forward, if he claimed at 70, he'd keep getting the 1320, but because he claimed a month early, he's going to only get 1313.30, right? That 0.67% reduction. So it is true that claiming at age 70, in the long run, he's going to get a little bit more every month. But he starts out ahead about $1,000 that first year. So it'll take him until about age 83 before he, quote, breaks even, which that should sound familiar because most of the actuarial calculations for how they determine your Social Security benefits at different ages are based on having the break-even point be at about 83, 84 years old. And that's because that's median life expectancy, approximately. It doesn't work out exactly. There's rounding errors and things like that in this whole process. But it's not surprising that this break-even point happens to be, you know, early to mid-80s. That's typical. But the difference is very, very tiny every single month, right? We're talking about $6.70 a month difference, or $80.40 a year. But he starts out $1,000 ahead, roughly. That's where that 12-year period before you hit break-even comes in. So this is why I stand by my original answer, is it really doesn't make that much difference. And if anything, I'd say if you want a windfall that first year, if you're strapped for cash in the first year, claiming a month early gets you a full month early of benefit while giving you just a tiny bit of sacrifice, and you'd be money ahead that particular month. I just proved it with the math. If you had a $1,000 benefit, you're ahead $1,000. If your benefit's $2,000, you're ahead $2,000. So I stick to my original answer because of that. What I would like to do is give a gold star to both of the people who wrote in, because they're definitely paying attention to this show. And I think the other one mentioned he'd read it somewhere else. So we're not the only place in the universe you could have gotten this information about how delayed retirement credits work. But if you claim delayed retirement credits prior to turning age 70, they actually only award you the credits in the first year up until January of that year. Any credits earned in that year that you claim up until your claiming month don't get awarded to you as a top-up or increase in your benefit until January of the following year. It's just the way it works. But you can see here, break-even is out quite a ways, and you actually start out ahead. In this particular example, with a May birthday and claiming so close to 70, only a month off, you start out with a big head start, that $1,000 in the first month, if your benefit's $1,000. So that's the whole story. So kudos to them for paying attention and pointing out that I failed to mention all this. It's a lot of extra detail. My thinking was, you know, I've worked through enough of these that I knew that this all kind of worked out in the wash, and that claiming a month early versus 70 really wasn't going to make a much difference overall. So I didn't go down that path. But I appreciate them pointing out, hey, what happens if you do go down that path? Does it change your answer? Did you forget something? Is there, did you forget this and that caused you to actually have made an erroneous recommendation, I guess. I'd stand by what I said. And if nothing else, this adds a little bit of support for claiming at 69 and 11 months, honestly. Because the whole reason he was you'd consider claiming a month early is that you need the money. If you're in a position of needing the money, claiming a little early like that, you're going to forego just a tiny bit of delayed retirement credits, but collect a lot more money that first year. That first year. So if you're in a bind, you need the money, I'd shift a little bit more towards the 69 and 11 months. Even though it is true, you won't get the delayed retirement credits for that last year until January of the following year. So walking you through the math hopefully helped clarify that situation. If it made it more murky, ignore everything I just said and rely on the very simple answer I gave last time. But I appreciate what they brought to our attention.
Excellent. I knew you would. And for the record, that person said that he also follows Facebook and some blog posts, and also got that information from Facebook groups. And
it's pretty rare information. Most people don't go off into the weeds like we do, but there are a few others out there. So I have seen this elsewhere, but it's a little hard to track down. When I first heard about this years ago, it took me a while to verify that it was true. Because one person mentioned it, and I'm like, what? That's really how it works? And it took some digging to actually verify that that's actually how it works.
Okay. We've got a couple of more questions, or actually a bunch more questions, but we hope to get through a couple more questions. One is, I want to bring this emailer back for a return visit, folks, in case some of you are sitting on the edge of your seat. Do you remember, Chris, our 35-year-old panicky guy?
Oh, who had pulled out of the market. He did horrible market timing by accident.
Yes.
Bailed out at the bottom.
He bailed out at the bottom in March/April, yep. When, not so much April, but more March, when the COVID panic first hit, stock market dropped about 35%, stock market being the S&P 500 in this example, dropped about 35% in 3 weeks, fastest drop, I think, in U.S. stock market history, and panicked. And he moved his money at near the bottom to cash. Mm-hmm. But we did want to congratulate him, and we did, for being 35 and saving over, I believe, $500,000.
I think that was right, yeah.
Right.
Very atypical for a 35-year-old, exactly. Unless they're just making bank. Mm-hmm.
So he wrote back to us to give us an update. Mm-hmm. And I like kind of what he had. Well, we'll chat about what he had to say.
Okay.
So he wanted to bring us up to date. Now, he wrote a long email. I'm going to get to the nitty-gritty. And he writes, as you remember from my question in podcast number 2035, I am now mainly in cash and stable value. Mm-hmm. So remember, folks, what he did is he panicked in his 401k at age 35 and sold at the market bottom. And when he wrote to us, he was still in cash. So here's what he did, in case people are wondering. However, I'm getting back into the market now, and I'm going to give up on trying to time the market and speculation. So we should give a little clap. Do we have that little applause?
We do.
Excellent. So he's going to stop trying to time the market and worrying. And again, listeners in general and listener in particular, he fell victim, Chris, to risk tolerance, which is the emotional reaction to a loss. But we were fixated in his email question on risk capacity, mm-hmm. which is a measure not of your emotional reaction to a loss, but essentially to your lifestyle reaction to a loss. In other words, would a significant loss on $500,000 to someone who is going to spend that money in 30 or more years impact their lifestyle today? No. This person had incredible risk capacity. It's called risk capacity to capture like a boxer has the capacity to handle a few hits, folks, in his or her stomach area. Thank you. God, those B's and M's and pretty much anything between A and Z just screw me up. Abdomens.
No, just go with stomach area.
Stomach area. Where am I going wrong on that word?
Abdomen?
Abdomen. Never mind.
It's okay. You got nothing to prove here.
I do have something to prove that the English language, come on. What is it with M's and N's and...
I don't know. Imagine the abdomen on the abominable snowman.
Oh. Ha, 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 ha. And we're going to protect his anonymity. All right. So anyways, what I'm getting at, capacity, folks, has to do with the ability of your portfolio, essentially, like the stomach area of a boxer, to take some hits. And if the boxer has a lot of capacity in his stomach area, he can take hits. Same thing we look as retirement planners when we're trying to help people position assets, if you will, and invest. We have to look at what would a drop in those assets cause. Would it cause a change in lifestyle? Well, what if he wasn't 35? What if he was 65 or 70 or 75? And all his money had just dropped 35%. That very well may impact where he would have to cut his lifestyle, even if it was just fun spending that he had to cut. To Chris and I, that is a major problem. Just because it's quote-unquote discretionary fun spending for a 65- or 70-year-old doesn't mean we want our clients to have to cut that. Especially because Chris and I ascribe to the belief that... I nailed that word. You didn't think I was going to get that, did you?
Very nice. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So Chris and I believe in the fact that as we age, we're going to go through a go-go, slow-go, no-go phase on fun spending. I've kind of digressed a little, but I'm trying to lay the framework, folks. This gentleman was only 35, and he panicked from a risk tolerance or an emotional reaction to the loss. He hated looking at his statement and seeing it down a lot, and he lost sight, Chris, of the bigger picture, which was, I don't have to cut my lifestyle any. This is money that the 65-year-old me is going to spend. I'm only 35, and in 30 years, I'm going to more than make up. I'm going to grow from here. But that's not the way he looked at it. So instead, he panicked. And he's acknowledging that. And he continues, hopefully others can learn from me and not look at your statement during rough times, which was my recommendation to him, if you remember. I said jokingly, but with a little bit of truth in my sarcasm, I wish the government passed a law that didn't show people the value of their accounts. Not that they would ever pass that law, but... if you couldn't see it, did it happen?
Well, that's deep.
But that's the whole point. And if you didn't know you lost 35% in 3 weeks, would you panic over it? But anyways, here's what he's decided to do. He's going to stop timing the market. He's going to stop planning, stop looking at his statements. And here's what he's going to do. I am now planning on moving the majority of this 401k account into my Roth 401k beginning in 2021. And therefore, I just moved, and he just sent this to us a couple months ago. I haven't gotten to it. It's been almost 2 months that he sent us this letter. Therefore, I just moved my entire account, 100% of it, back into the market. He did that, Chris, the end of August. Mm-hmm. So that has treated him well, because September and October, the markets have been positive. But it doesn't matter, even if it lost. Who cares? He doesn't need this money, and he isn't going to spend this money for 30, 35 more years. Mm-hmm. So he writes, if this money now goes up, that will be great too. I would be okay, though, with the account now dropping, because it's going to make my tax implications a little more favorable. And that's what I want to point out. Instead of panicking, Chris, when he moved to all cash, he probably should have done a conversion in the market. When he was getting out, he should have turned lemons into lemonade, folks, and looked at his portfolio and said, wow, I'm down 30, 35, 40, 45%, whatever he was down.
Which means my taxes are now exactly down 30, 35, 40%. Yeah.
And instead, it's too bad he didn't do the conversion then. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to know, what do we think of his new approach? I think he's smart. He's going to stop looking at his statement, stop being driven by the emotional reaction to a loss, turn lemons into lemonade, that if the market drops, he's going to pay less in taxes as he begins a Roth conversion strategy next year. He does indicate in his first two paragraphs why he's waiting to next year to do the conversions. I don't want to get into that. He makes good points in that, but that's fine. But right now, I think what he's doing is wise. He's going to stop being driven by emotional hurdles, if you will, or emotional reactions to losses. He's realizing his risk capacity is quite high, and he's going to try to convert selectively every year and try to get the majority of his money, if he can, in a tax-efficient manner into a Roth. I think that's great, and especially during the Trump tax cuts, take advantage of those. So he did ask one, I don't want to say rhetorical question, but I believe we just recently answered this. He wanted to know, Chris, and I'll let you answer his question and give your thoughts on his strategy. But his question is, how will his taxes be calculated on a conversion of a 401k? Is it the value on the day of conversion or the value on December 31st in the year he did the conversion? So he wants to know that, and he wants to know your thoughts on his new approach. I already know my thoughts, mm-hmm. and I already know the answer to his question, but I'll let you do it.
I like the way it sounds like he's changed his mind on how to think about this or how to react to things during this accumulation phase when he's so early on it. He is only 35 at this point. As far as the conversion amount, it's the day you do the conversion, that is going to trigger the value of that conversion amount, which will be reported on the 1099 that you're going to get from the 401k itself. So you're going to pay tax. So you can actually time it. What I mean by that is if the market goes down and you're converting because of that, you'll be able to lock in the value at that point of those assets that you are converting. So if they did it as December 31st, you'd never be able to take advantage of any type of dip like that, like we're describing. So it happens, they'll keep track of it and report it as of the day that you pulled the trigger. So that's how that works. And in general, it's fine. One thing I do want to point out, and I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, so I'm not mentioning this so that Jim can have a 40-minute conversation on dollar cost averaging, but some people are going to say, oh my gosh, he made another huge error. He got back in the market in one step. A lot of the research that's coming out now, if you look at the long-term results via dollar cost averaging versus just jumping back in the market like he did, very little difference as far as kind of taking the dollar cost averaging has been held up as this fabulous, most, you know, much smarter way to get back in the market than just putting it all in, like he said. And a lot of that results even, I think even Kitsis has been doing some stuff in this area. And not a big deal. Not that one is better than the other. It just turns out that they both, in the long term, end up being about the same. So it's not worth a lot of the headache. If you want to dive right back in, dive right back in. But then you're going to have to ignore any short-term, don't react negatively to a short-term decline, or you're just going to compound your bad decision from before into another bad decision. But I have no problem with what he did, getting back in the way he did, especially when he's got 30 years probably until he needs any of this money, putting it to work right away. And then we don't know, we actually don't have enough information to ultimately decide whether Roth conversions are a good idea or not for him. They likely are, but he hasn't shared any. Maybe he did with Jim and Jim's not sharing it, but I haven't heard anything about his overall tax situation.
Negative. He hasn't shared any
of
that.
So, obviously you'd want to look at that whole scope of things and not just assume because he's 35 that it's a no-brainer. It's likely that it's a good idea, but we'd want to know more about his overall situation before we decided that absolutely for sure it was a good idea. But I like the way he's headed.
And did you answer, I didn't pay attention, I was looking at other things, his question on what he's going to pay taxes on year end? Okay, perfect. And he asked also, would that apply to an IRA as well? And the answer is yes.
Yes, on both counts.
I think we had a question just last week on
just
that
recently,
as well.
Just recently, actually, yeah.
So it's so, listeners, you pay taxes not on the December 31st value. Your required minimum distributions are based on the December 31st value of the previous year, not the value of your account on the day you take the RMD. So that might be what they're conflating. But on a conversion, you pay taxes on the value on the day of conversion, not on what it's worth on December 31st. So do keep that in mind. And it applies whether it's an IRA or a Roth IRA. Okay,
perfect.
Next question. Mm-hmm. This one is a pretty good one, and it comes back to more of the art part of financial planning, or in this case, tax planning. And the reason I want to answer this one today is I've got a couple of actual stories of cases that we can share with them on just recently what we're trying to do for some people. Mm. But this comes from a listener out of, he doesn't say. All right, somewhere in the United States, but he does sign his name, quote unquote, George. So his name is either really George or he's just pretending to be George. He says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I listen to your podcast and love it. The three accounts that you use, never taxable, always taxable, and sometimes taxable. Can you explain why anyone should even bother with a sometimes taxable account?" So before you start answering this, Chris, mm-hmm. he wants to know, why do we recommend people have money in all three? And for those listeners who don't know, to Chris and I, we word things differently. We don't follow conventional retirement planning, quote unquote, wisdom. We have our own approach. And in my simplified approach to retirement, distributions from accounts are going to be taxed one of three ways: always, never, or maybe. So to us, you can have an always taxable account, an account whose withdrawals will always be taxable. Those are IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, 457s, money purchase pension plans, TSPs. There's a ton of them out there. The industry calls them qualified retirement accounts, although an IRA is not technically a qualified account in the tax code definition, it's often lumped into that category. And yes, it is possible that some of a withdrawal from an always taxable account is actually a tax-free return of basis. So we're not going to dispute that here. But 99.99999% of the time, Chris, withdrawals from an always taxable account, like I just described, are always going to be subject to income taxes. Then you can have a never taxable account. In Chris and I's world, that's generally Roth IRAs with what is known as a qualified distribution.
Now, to clarify that too, when we say never taxable, never taxable going forward.
Correct.
Obviously, there were taxes paid on that income that you earned before, but that's water under the bridge. You're
when
not
you put
undoing
the money
it, right?
In.
It's done deal. Moving forward is what we're talking about.
Right, because we're looking at this as a retiree. When you're taking withdrawals from your accounts, will those with... So we're not paying attention, as Chris said, to when the money went in and you had to pay taxes on it inside the Roth. We're looking post-retirement, distribution, consumption phase of your life. Remember, in my approach, this is no longer an asset. It is deferred spending. So now you're going to start spending the money, Chris, and it's going to start coming from accounts. And these accounts are going to fall into one of three categories. Accounts whose withdrawals will always be subject to taxes. Accounts whose withdrawals will never be subject to taxes. But I want to point out, in the case of a Roth, it must be a qualified withdrawal, meaning it qualifies for the tax-free treatment. In short, you're over the age of 59 and a half, and the Roth is at least 5 years old, or you've been in the Roth program for at least 5 years. It doesn't mean that that Roth has to be 5 years old. You contributed to a Roth at some point in your life, 5 years or more from the day you want to take the money out. That's all it simply means.
And it's earnings.
Correct. And it's earnings, because your money can come out at any time for any reason, no taxes, no penalties. Right. Now, that said, a qualified withdrawal over the age of 59 and a half, and your Roth is at least, the Roth is at least 5 years old, and you are over the age of 59 and a half, dead, which doesn't help you, but helps your beneficiaries, disabled, or buying a first-time home. That's how you get a qualified withdrawal. You're over the age of 59 and a half, and, you have a Roth that's at least 5 years old, and you're over the age of 59 and a half, dead, disabled, or buying a first-time home. Okay, and then you have the point of his question, Chris. Bank and brokerage assets are what we're talking about here, folks. Mm-hmm. I call them maybe taxable. And he wants to know, why do we do that? Why do we encourage people to have maybe taxable accounts? To him, it makes no sense, because he goes on and says, my experience has shown me I am always getting taxed when I make money in this pot, and always has been short-term capital gains. Now, when I lose money, Uncle Sam does not cover me. But my golly, he takes what he wants in taxes when I make one measly dollar on these accounts. Seems to me all I should ever put my money in is never taxable Roths. And that's his point. Seems to me all I ever should save my money in should be only in Roths. So he's questioning our concept of maybe taxable.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll let you answer as well. But when I got this, I wanted to share with the listener just a couple of reasons. Now, Chris runs the planning department here, so he may get into this a little bit deeper and have even better examples than mine of why we like money in the sometimes taxable. Listener, if you're being nailed on taxes and most of it short-term gains, which is being taxed you as ordinary income, it's being managed probably wrong. Remember, these types of banks and brokerage accounts, listeners, I don't know what you're invested in, you're not saying, but I'm guessing you're either actively trading it and you're getting hit with very short-term capital gains. I don't know, but you did indicate your taxes are being based on short-term cap gains, so you're owning it for a year or less. So you're either actively managing it and not holding your investments for a year or more, or you're using some type of actively managed mutual funds that are actively trading and pushing out a lot of short-term gains. That's the only thing I can think of. Mm-hmm. And when you said, listener, when you lose money, Uncle Sam does not cover you, then you are not doing proper tax planning there, listener. Because everyone, irrespective of your level of income, is allowed to take $3,000 of either long-term or short-term gains that haven't been netted out. I don't want to get too deep into how maybe taxable accounts net out short-term against short-term, long-term against long-term, then long-term against short-term, yada, yada, yada. I don't want to get too deep into that. But if you have losses that have not been netted out in any tax year, you can carry those forward and you can, so they don't go to waste, and you are allowed to use up to $3,000 a year. Granted, it's not much, but every little bit helps. You're allowed to use $3,000 a year of that loss carry forward that hasn't been netted out in any particular tax year. You can use it against ordinary income. You can deduct it against ordinary income. So if your income tax bracket, say, is the 32% tax bracket, you're going to get almost $1,000 on that $3,000 of losses from the government back, because they're going to let you deduct $3,000 of losses against your ordinary income and not have to pay taxes on it. So the government does, I don't want to say has your back, so to speak, but they are, Uncle Sam does cover you. He helps you a little bit. It would be great if you could deduct an unlimited amount of that every year against ordinary income, but they don't let you do that. So they do have your back there. You need to look at your investments, listener. You need to look at your level of trading. And you need to make sure you're doing tax-optimized sales, or at least an analysis, every year. But also, let me give you some other actual examples of how some people use this. If you have a lot of money in these maybe taxable accounts, it is quite possible, listener, when you first retire, especially if you're not age 65 yet, to live off of the basis in those accounts, because you should be specifying to your custodian. And this might be one of the things you're doing wrong, listener. If you haven't specified to your custodian that you want to use specific share identification, your custodian may be defaulting to LIFO or FIFO accounting. Last in, first out, which means earnings first, which could be why you're being hit with a lot of short-term gains first. If they're doing LIFO accounting, last in, which is interest and dividends, is the last money that came back in, and you might be exposed to that first, I don't know. Or FIFO accounting, first in, first out. In other words, the custodians might be defaulting to an accounting mechanism that is not allowing you to cherry pick the best gains and the best losses to reduce your taxes. So look at what you told your custodian to use for their accounting method. They should be using specific share identification, and you, listener, should be tracking every purchase you make, even if you're doing it in a mutual fund platform or to a lesser degree an ETF platform. ETFs tend to be inherently more tax efficient than mutual funds. But if you're using mutual funds, they tend to be less tax efficient. But you should be telling your custodian you want to use specific share identification, and you should be identifying every share. And when you need money, you should only be selling shares and offsetting them with losses from other shares. In other words, you should be trying to optimize your tax gains with tax losses. And if you're using mutual funds and they're generating a lot of short-term cap gains, you got to replace those damn funds. They're not tax efficient. But people who have a lot of money by time they retire in brokerage accounts, listener, could then use specific share identification to sell a lot of the basis. In other words, a lot of the money that they've initially put into those accounts, and they can free those shares up with very little, perhaps, taxable gain. I don't know. Or maybe some of the more recent purchase shares and leave the older shares because they have a lot of embedded gains, or offset them with losses and realize very little capital gains, therefore, listener, very little income, and therefore they might qualify for what, Chris, between 60 and 65, or 65?
Between 60 and
60
65.
And 65, yes.
ACA premium tax credits.
Exactly. And we have clients doing that all the time. So let me give you an example of someone who did something recently. They did this for themselves. What they did is the first year they retired, listener, they were both 64. And they have over $1.5 million, almost $2 million. But they have about $500,000 of that in a maybe taxable account and the rest in IRAs. So what they did is the first year of retirement, they wanted to get premium tax credits. So we realized enough money, or they realized, Chris, enough money to keep themselves off of Medicaid, but to qualify for a lion's share, if you will, of premium tax credits. So their income was manipulated in the first year by spending from their brokerage account and a little bit from their IRA. They made enough to not be forced onto Medicaid, but they got the majority of the premium tax credits from the federal government. So the feds picked up their first year of retirement, last year of being on the private insurance market, the feds picked up most of that premium bill for their health insurance. Now, this year, what they've done is they've continued to manipulate their spending. They spend about $6,000 a month, $72,000 a year, and they're taking the majority of that as tax-free from their maybe taxable account. And you may be wondering, why are they doing that? Why don't they just take it from their IRA now? They've got $1 million-plus in an IRA. They're going to be hit with required minimum distributions. Why aren't you converting a lot of that? The reason they're not doing it this year, they have $57,000 of gains in their brokerage account. By manipulating the amount of income they're going to make this year and keeping it very low, they are in the 12% bracket or less. They're actually going to be in the 10% bracket. But if you are in the 12 to 10% bracket, you pay a big, fat, whopping zero in capital gains taxes. What they have to be careful is they don't exercise too much in capital gains that pulls some of their cap gains into taxation. But they've crunched the numbers. Their tax person, named Bob, has looked through a lot of this and has determined they can take their entire brokerage account and reallocate it, sell it all, and move it all to tax advantage ETFs from the tax, less tax advantaged, if you will, mutual funds their previous advisor had them in. So by having some money in a maybe taxable account. Granted, I agree. If they had money in a never taxable account, they could have done this as well. But they don't. They didn't save in never taxable. But they didn't start doing conversions the first year because they wanted ACA. The second year, Chris, because of the way a maybe taxable may or may not be subject to taxation account works. They are going, just so it happens, they are going to be able to realize it all. And then buy very tax-efficient ETFs and owe a big fat zero, Chris, in capital gains. That's $57,000, 100% tax-free. And then beginning in the next year, year three of retirement, and lasting for another 4 or 5 years, I forget exactly how much, they're going to do Roth conversion optimizations before they hit age 72. They're both the same age, hit age 72 and get subject to required minimum distributions. They're going to try to start getting a lot of their money into Roths. But do you see how they used, Chris, maybe taxable accounts to their advantage? And in this case, it's clearly maybe taxable because they're managing it, I think, a little better. So that's my answer to him of why you want maybe taxable. I think the issue is he's not managing it right and looking at tax loss selling and maybe owns the wrong type of investments in it. But what are your thoughts?
I'm going to go a little different direction because I don't think you answered his question. His question wasn't, what do I do now that I have a maybe taxable account?
Well, wait. His question was, can you explain why I would even want to bother with sometimes taxable accounts?
Correct.
This is why.
No. Time out. Let me answer. I gave you your time.
Never mind.
Because if you could accumulate all the money that you need for retirement inside always and never taxable and not to have to put anything into maybe taxable, what he calls sometimes taxable, you could accomplish everything that Jim mentioned and not need maybe taxable. The reason why people have maybe taxable is that they, because of contribution limits and also the restrictions on withdrawals, so the withdrawal rules from retirement accounts, they're either unwilling or unable to amass all of their wealth in always taxable and never taxable. But if you had just those two, you do not need maybe taxable. Now, it's impractical for most people to do that. So most people do end up with maybe taxable as one of the three. Sometimes they don't have three. They'll have maybe and always, or maybe in a tiny bit of never and always, or, you know, that sort of thing. But most people end up with some maybe. But if the goal was to do this the easiest way possible, you don't do maybe taxable. There's no inherent advantage to maybe if you can overcome the contribution limit issue and the withdrawal restriction issues with the retirement accounts.
No, that's a very good point. If you can get the money in always taxable or never taxable at a reasonable cost.
Not really or, and you do want the diversification because then you can pull off the things Jim was talking about, manipulating your income for ACA premium tax credits. That is valuable. So you want to have some in the never taxable for that particular purpose. So we like the diversification of having both of them, but it is not practical for most people to get all of their retirement savings in those two without making some other sacrifices or, again, just simply being blocked, being able to put enough in there because of contribution limits.
Right. And even I like how you pointed out withdrawal issues. If you're going to retire before the age of 59 and a half, right, try early. You could, now granted there's the rule of 55 and a couple of other things to avoid an early withdrawal penalty, but you do have these penalties on early withdrawals where you don't on a maybe taxable account.
Right.
And you have complete access to your money in a maybe taxable account whenever you want during your working years. You don't have to wait for in-service distributions and transfers and rollovers and things of that nature.
So those are the practical reasons why people end up with money in the maybe taxable category. But if you could, again, not be affected by contribution or withdrawal issues with the retirement accounts. Filling up just always and never. That would be the simplest way to go and accomplish everything that you need. There's no inherent other advantage
right.
to, that I can identify of the maybe taxable.
Well, we could get a little bit into the weeds. You do have to look at the cost of getting money into never taxable. Now, granted, it's going to cost you the same to get it into never taxable as a maybe taxable.
Yep.
So do recognize that, but the contribution limits can really burn you and you can't get more in. So
that's the reason why most people don't.
They
get to a point of earnings and their contributions are limited where they just need to accumulate more before they retire than can fit into, than they can shove into the retirement accounts. That's why people don't. But if they could, if they were in a situation where they didn't just need to accumulate that much, you don't have to have a goal to create maybe taxable. The goal is to get the maybe taxable that you accidentally create or you end up creating out the most efficiently possible. So that's where we get into all the things that Jim was talking about. So that's, I think Jim has a more practical answer that your goal to just have the two is likely not practical.
And one of the worst things to do, listener, is to overfund, which the vast majority of you do-it-yourselfers have done this. You know it. Look at yourself in the mirror. You know you're out there. 70, 80, 90% of your money is in always taxable accounts.
Yeah.
And you're starting to realize, holy moly, I'm going to get nailed.
Right. You can't do any ACA premium tax credit manipulation.
Nope.
Your RMDs are going to be gigantic. You have no flexibility. You've painted yourself into a corner. You're at the mercy of the tax laws in the years that you're taking the money
And then
out.
When you pass away and your children inherit mm-hmm. your wealth, you're going, they're going to get nailed in
right.
taxes
yep.
because of the 10-year rule now, which I still firmly believe will be back to the old 5-year rule. And you can't protect and control those assets because of the rules with a trust as beneficiary of an IRA. And if you're a longtime listener to this show, you know trusts and IRAs mix like oil and water. But trusts and maybe taxable accounts mix like peanut butter and chocolate. They go so well together.
As do never taxable accounts.
Yes. A Roth is peanut butter and chocolate as well with trusts. So there's a lot of reasons why you don't want to do what you recommended, listener, of just fund your never taxable and may, excuse me, always taxable and never taxable and ignore the maybe taxable. I'm trying to point out to you that even though it's not working for you, I think you have to look at how you're managing that money. I think there might be something you're not doing, or you've got the wrong investments. But occasionally, that's why we call it maybe. Sometimes there's some people who can really benefit. The people I just talked about, Chris, what if they had all of it in always taxable accounts? They would not have qualified for ACA.
No, but if they had all the maybe in never,
it would have been better.
It would have been totally fine.
But they were limited, I can tell you
right.
for sure, because of the amount of money that they made during their working
right. they
years.
They couldn't do it.
They were greatly limited. They may have wanted to,
but they could not do it.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And that's why they have about a third of their assets in maybe, and it's that third they're going to manipulate into almost, Chris, a never.
Yeah. Yeah, which isn't always, you're not always able to pull that off. But
no. That's I wanted to give an extreme example, and that is one. That's why we call it maybe. Always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. And one other thing, because a lot of you do-it-yourselfers are convinced or just striving. It's like this goal of yours to get all your money in never taxable Roths. That's just this fixated goal of many people. Got to be careful on that. You got to look at the cost of getting that money out of your always taxable account and into your never taxable account. You've got to do tax projections, deep forward-looking tax projections, and also recognize Once you get it all in a never taxable account, if you're getting it in at 22, 24, 28, 32% brackets, you are going to permanently give up your 10 and 12 and 22 bracket. Now, it's quite possible those lower brackets are being filled with pension income, Social Security income, annuity income, or RMDs. We won't dispute that. But you've got to do calculations to see if you're wasting any of those lower brackets in the future before you try to get everything in at a higher bracket. So do keep that in mind as well. Tax planning. To me, Chris, a good advisor can add far more in alpha on the tax side than they can on the investment side.
I agree.
On the investment side, it's been all commoditized. It is passive, low fee, simplicity. You and I are all on board with that. There's very little alpha that can be added on the investment side. It's really about convenience, handling the due diligence. Not for you, but if you hire an advisor, when we manage money, we call them, folks, convenience portfolios. Our clients could do it themselves. We got some incredibly smart clients. Do you want them? Do you want to do it yourself? We'll do the due diligence. We'll do the asset mapping to the appropriate benchmarks, find the appropriate ETFs, rebalance twice a year, do all the administrative paperwork when you need a conversion, when you need a distribution, a QCD. That's what you're paying for. For asset management, you're really paying, honestly, in my opinion, Chris, you can agree or disagree, you're really paying for the convenience. Years ago, yes, you were paying for the investment alpha that allegedly a human advisor would add, but computers do it all now and remove the emotions of the advisor. And I think a lot of investment management has been commoditized, yet is still priced, Chris, outrageous, as if it's still being done the old-fashioned way 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when I first started studying in this. I've been in this for 22 years, but I started studying 6 years before that. It's been almost 30 years that I've been in this. A lot has changed. But on the tax side, that's where I think a good advisor can add a lot of alpha. It's trying to control the taxes that people are going to pay. And that's what you need to be looking for. So you do-it-yourselfers, it's really not going to be about your investment management prowess anymore. That's been commoditized. You need to start looking at your tax planning capabilities. Can you project your taxes? Can you predict your taxes? Can you optimize your taxes? That's what you need to start doing. And that is much harder to do on your own. I'll freely admit that. Anyways, that's all I have to say.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of another Q&A show here at the Retirement and IRA Show. And we want to appreciate everybody for listening. If you have questions, please send them in by going to our website, jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there, you can learn a little bit more about us. There's a contact form. You can submit questions or comments about the show. And that's where we get all these questions from. And we really appreciate it. We really honestly like the ones where people were paying so much attention to our previous shows that they bring up something that they have an additional question about or think that there's an error. Sometimes we do make a mistake, Jim. And no, I've clearly made mistakes before. I wouldn't call this episode, quote, a mistake in the first question that I kind of went over. I agree that I could have gone into the weeds a little bit farther on the ramifications of the decision, but nevertheless.
Well,
I'm never offended when somebody calls us out on something. I like it because I don't want to have anything out there that is wrong or misleading or something that we haven't corrected. So if you bring our attention to it, we'll
right. We're not perfect. We're not infallible. We're humans. We may not say something correctly, but I know we're going to wrap up, but you just hit on something, and I want people to understand why I go so deep into the weeds. Chris hit the nail on the head. He knew everything that those people pointed out. I like mentioning Chris and misspelling the name J-I-M, yada, yada. That's a running joke between Chris and I. He and I get along so well, we can do that. But now you understand why I go so deep in the weeds sometimes, and we only got through three or four questions today. I like to get deep in. Chris is much less deeper he doesn't get as deep in. But it's not because you didn't know all of this. And if he was a deeper talker or liked to get into the weeds like I do, he definitely would have talked about that. That was the quote-unquote mistake. He just didn't tell the whole story. But he's sticking to his guns on this, and I agree with his original answer. He just didn't get deeper into the weeds. But now you know why, folks, a lot of times I do. And I can take, I mean, God, if there's anyone on the face of this earth who can take what seems like a benign question and turn it into a long discussion, it would be yours truly, because I'm going to try to look at this from many different levels. And just keep that in mind. It all reminds me, Chris, of the first time our show started about 12 years ago now, 13, I don't even know how many years ago it was. Remember when we were just 1 half hour mm-hmm. on a Greeley radio station, little pitsy little Greeley radio station.
Well,
nice
the
station.
Oldest radio station oldest west station of the Mississippi.
Right. KFKA, King of Farming, King of Agriculture, KFKA. The oldest radio station. It's a very nice station. But Chris and I went out to eat with the general manager, and I always remember when you and I told him we were not going to do a stock jock show. We weren't going to talk about stocks or investing or any of that. And he's like, well, what are you guys going to talk about? And I said, retirement and IRAs. And then he said to us, well, how long do you think that show is going to go on for? I'm paraphrasing. And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, aren't you going to run out of things to eventually talk about? I never forget that.
He thought we'd be done in less than a year.
Yes.
We'll have talked about every possible thing.
Got everything we could have possibly said will be done in a year's worth of half-hour shows right. on a Saturday.
Exactly.
And I looked at him and I said, I could do this show 3 hours a day, every single day, and never run out of things to say. And I just remember the look on his face like, yeah, right, sure, pal. And here we are 12, 15 years later, doing it twice a week, talking for hours. And you know, Chris, if I had my say, you and I would do this every day. We wouldn't work.
Oh, come
on.
We
would just do this. But what I'm getting at is we literally could do the retirement and IRA show every day for 3 hours. Not that we're going to, and not run out of things to say. And that's the key. And that's why we go deep into things, and we do appreciate people who point these out. Hey, should you not have mentioned this? Absolutely, and let's talk about it. And that's all we did today.
Nice.
All right.
So, yeah, thanks, everybody, for another visit with us on the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.